Hello, Baker Street Babes. My name is Elena, and I'm a big fan of your podcast. I live in Finland, and actually, I don't know any other Sherlockians here where I live. So I can honestly say that it was your podcast and blog that made me find other Sherlockians and the amazing Sherlock Holmes fandom in all its forms. And above all, I found Tumblr. And now I've even made friends with Sherlockians from other countries and found another Finnish ones too. So I just wanted to say thank you, babes. Secondly, have you ever thought about discussing in your podcast what it is like to be a Sherlockian in different countries? Like to interview some Sherlockians from different countries and discuss with them if Sherlock Holmes is a big deal in their countries or not? Do they have any Sherlockian societies and stuff like that? I think it would be a very interesting topic. Thank you for your awesome podcast and lots of love from Finland. Bye!
Hello, Elena! Thank you so much for your message. And for those of you who don't know, you can now leave us voicemails on our website. If you go to bakerstreetbabes.com, there's this obnoxious little thing that'll pop out being like, leave us a voicemail! And that's how you can do it. So to answer your question, I think that's actually a really interesting topic because we do get a lot of requests of people being like, oh, do you know if there's any groups here? I want to do a meetup. And so I think it'd be really interesting to talk to people around the world. How did you find your group? What are you looking for in a group around the world? And just being like, yeah, being a Sherlock Holmes fan around the world. I think, no, that's really good. And thank you for the suggestion. It's definitely gone into our list of future topics. For those of you who are interested in hosting a meetup or finding a group, there's a few places that you can go. If you go to Sherlockian.net, there's a list of the various groups around the world that you can look for. There's also SherlockMeetup.livejournal.com, where you can post about a meetup that you want to have or see what other ones that people are having. Also, always feel free to email us, tweet us, or send us an ask on Facebook or Tumblr, and we will promote things for you. So say you're out in the middle of nowhere, like Oklahoma, say you want to host a meetup, we will send it to the masses, and it will be grand. So yes, thank you, Elena. Much love back to Finland.
I would like to take a few moments to thank our wonderful sponsors. First, there's Gazagine Books, which is dedicated to the study of Sherlock Holmes and his world. Go and visit their website, which you can find under www.wessexpress.com. You'll find tons of super interesting publications on Holmes and Doyle. They're also hosting a series of conferences concerning theatre and film versions of Holmes at Indiana University, called From Gillette to Brett. Next year's conference is titled Basil, Benedict and Beyond, so go on and check out their website. Secondly, there's the Baker Street Journal, which is the leading Sherlockian publication, edited by the most wonderful Steve Rothman. The journal is concerned with all things Sherlock Holmes, publishing articles which range from werewolf AUs to detailed discussions about the canon stories and character analyses. Go and subscribe to the journal today under www.bakerstreetjournal.com or follow them on Twitter under BakerSTJournal for interesting tweets about important Sherlockian dates and facts. Last but not least, there's the Scintillation of Science, which is an annual symposium of fans of Sherlock Holmes, Dr. Watson, and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, sponsored by Watson's Tin Box in Maryland. The event includes speakers and attendees from around the US, as well as local Sherlockians. A tradition was established to have at least one first-time presenter at the event in order to offer an opportunity for them to have the experience of speaking to a crowd of like-minded people. Go and check out their website for more information under www.scintillation.org.
Oh, they call us the irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street Babes, always leave the rest of them behind. Oh, so when Scotland Yard they send you home, you feel like you're losing your got you crying, won't you two mine?
Ladies and gentlemen, and all of the listeners, be they cat, dogs, what have you, houseplants, Welcome to episode 46 of the Baker Street Video Podcast. Today we're going to be featuring Mr. Daniel Corey.
Hello.
Hello. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure. I'm so excited to be on the Baker Street Babe show. I can't tell you. It's just I'm kind of nervous. Yeah, I know. It's a little intimidating. The legend, you know, that we're dealing with here. Now, can I start off asking you guys a question?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
The song. Who does the song? The theme song.
Caitlin Obaum.
Oh, I love this song. And you know what I especially love about it? Mm. The word quotidian is used.
I was pleased with that.
I've never heard the word quotidian used in a song. Well, ever.
Caitlin has a lot going for her, and that's one of the things.
That's how awesome she is.
It was our one requirement.
Yeah, okay. Cool. Well, that's all I had. What did you guys want to talk about?
Well, we have a bit of an agenda to get through first, if you want to be an honorary Baker Street Babe, which I imagine.
Oh, my gosh. This is massive, yes.
So episode 46 of the Baker Street Babes podcast will commence with your being grilled a bit, Daniel. Are you okay? And I should introduce you with a little more detail than actually happened, because you are the creator of the series of comics titled Moriarty.
Yes.
There are two issues out previously that any of our listeners can pick up at the moment. They are available singly and in book form. Am I right about that?
The single issues are pretty much sold out, but we have two collected paperback trades, volumes 1 and 2, and then those were collected together into the Moriarty Deluxe Edition hardcover, which is also available. So that would be the one that would probably be easiest to find right now, is the Moriarty Deluxe Edition hardcover.
So these are Moriarty as protagonist comics, and we will get to that because that's awesome. But I have to ask you our, trial by fire questions first. And,
okay.
Number one, I believe, is how did you get involved with Sherlock Holmes and the world of Sherlock Holmes?
Well, my first exposure, Sherlock Holmes is a thing you hear about from the time that you are able to perceive language, pretty much, you know. And if you were like me as a child, you watched any number of hours of Warner Brothers cartoons, Bugs Bunny and stuff. So, like, there was always Sherlock Holmes around. But then it was about the time I was probably like 10 when it was like the local – I think it was local ABC affiliate in our hometown. On Sunday afternoons, we'd play the old Basil Rathbone movies. And I don't remember the first one that I saw, but – I started watching this and I was just mesmerized, and my dad was watching me watch it. He's like, so you like Sherlock Holmes? Like, this is great. You know, he can figure out everything. This is amazing. You know? So from there, I think probably like that week, my mom like went and picked up an old book that had like four of the stories, and like The Red-Headed League was the first story I ever read. It was from that little book, you know? And then from there I got one of those gigantic tomes, you know, the complete collection with the foreword by Christopher Morley, you know, and I used to carry that around and read that on car trips and stuff. My entry was really the Basil Rathbone, the kind of like everybody's kind of first Sherlock movie probably, mm-hmm. was an old Basil Rathbone movie. So there, yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah, good. Good upbringing that you had. Your dad did the right thing.
Yeah.
Who amongst all of them, and I feel like this is a bit of a gimme question, so if you throw us a curveball here, then we will applaud for you. And
I'll try.
If you don't throw us a curve, we'll still like you. Anyway, who's your favorite character from the Sherlock Holmes mysteries?
My favorite character?
Right. And okay. It's like a president, you know, podcast. I mean, there would seem mm-hmm. to be one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I can't say Moriarty, because that's not like clever enough. I don't know. I'm getting thrown here. I'm trying. How obscure can I be? But
no. Who's your real favorite? We're just teasing you.
Yeah, oh, okay. Well, you know, Professor Moriarty, yeah, just the idea of him, you know, because he's really, in the original canon, is more of an idea.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? You know, I have an idea of Moriarty that, you know, he's you know, he's this concept that Holmes talks about to Watson. You know, it's almost as if he's not even real because he never really appears, quote, on stage, you know, in the stories, not really. But this idea of Moriarty being, you know, the spider at the center of the web is a concept that I think a lot of us just really latch onto. You know, it's like, oh, maybe this one central thing causing all the badness in the world. And yeah. I think it inspires a sense of heroism in us as people to think that, you know, it's like, oh, maybe I can get at it. You know, maybe I can find it and snuff it out like Sherlock Holmes does. You know, so that's what it really inspires me about Professor Moriarty is just this idea of the spider at the center of the web that is doing all this stuff that maybe would, you know, if we can get one step ahead of that in the world, we can be better people.
That is an amazing explication of Professor Moriarty.
Oh, thank you. I wasn't quite sure, but there you go. Okay.
That's beautiful, and it ties into Doyle's myth-making really well. So bearing that in mind, or not bearing it in mind at all, because clearly you're a fan of all of the canon, what is your favorite case? Excuse me.
Favorite case? Oh, yeah.
The short stories is your favorite, or of the novels, whatever.
Well, you know, I do, I have a lot of affection for the Red-Headed League, since that was the first one that I read. So I have a lot of affection for that story. I like the Speckled Band, you know, it's just creepy, scary snakes, you know. I'm actually terrified of snakes, so that story was scary to me, so I really like that one. Solitary Cyclist, you know, and that was, Solitary Cyclist is actually of the Jeremy Brett adaptations, that might be my favorite.
Oh, it's so good.
Yeah, but so those are some of my favorites. Greek Interpreter, because we got Mycroft, you know, and Bruce Partington, because there's more Mycroft there. So yeah, there you go.
You're listing the cases close to my heart, but I love that you picked the one that, to talk about first, the Red-Headed League, that was the first one that just sort of nagged you as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
That's very important. So
yes.
This question is a different question from who is your favorite character. If you were to pick somebody out of the entire Sherlock Holmes original canon and have tea with them,
oh.
And pick their brain. Who would you, with whom would you have tea?
Okay, obvious people aside, you know, slightly more obvious people aside, I'd say maybe Mycroft is like growing up with this guy, you know. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'd like to know about what did Doyle have in mind? What was their real childhood and upbringing really like? You know, so I would like to have that discussion with Mycroft.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
That is a great answer. And who doesn't want to know all of that backstory? And, you know, Pat, you should explore it constantly. So now we are on to, I guess, the main crux of talking about what you do. And what you do is you have conceived a series of comics / graphic novels that are featuring Professor Moriarty to a certain extent as the heroic protagonist.
Mm-hmm.
And they're gorgeous. They're very beautiful. And please, if you would give us like a little bit of background, just a brief overview of what you've already done, and then talk about the Kickstarter.
Okay, cool. All right. Well, first I'll talk about, I need to bring up Anthony. You mentioned how beautiful they are. Anthony Dietschidue is is the main artist on the series. And, he and I go back several years now. We did a project together first called Prophet. That was the first book that we did together. And that was kind of a supernatural spaghetti Western. We started that back in 2007. That was actually, just side note, Prophet was actually recently optioned by a film company, Outlier, principals being Eric Thompson, Mark Morgan and James Cotton. And they're responsible for the Twilight series and Percy Jackson series. So Prophet, be on the lookout for the Prophet movie at some point at a theater near you, please. So that was the first project Anthony and I did together. We just met through a neighbor, you know, here in Los Angeles. Our neighbor Mario introduced us. We got together, we did Prophet. Near the end of Prophet, I said, I came up with this idea to do a Professor Moriarty comic. And I said, Anthony, I'd like to do a Professor Moriarty comic. And he kind of, at first he's like, I don't know, period stuff. I'm not sure about that. And I'm like, well, think of it as like a horror movie with the guys in the top hats and the fog rolling through London. And he starts visualizing his mind. He's like, yeah, okay, I'm on, we're in. So, yeah. So, I mean, that's kind of how it really just kind of started. You know, Anthony is a brilliant artist. Some of the other guys that have worked on it, Mike Vosberg did layouts for our issue 6, and he did all the art for our issue 7. Mike's a comics legend and well-known to pop culture, mostly for Tales from the Crypt. He drew all the movie posters and the opening titles for Tales from the Crypt. Yeah, cool. So he and Anthony were friends. Yeah. He and Anthony are friends, and I got to know Mike, and he did that issue for us, which was the Jamaica story, which is like a flashback. So we were seeing a younger Moriarty than the one we had been drawing to that point, and in 1880 Jamaica. So I thought, hey, let's bring in another artist to do that one, and Mike did that. Perry Freeze did colors for us on several of the issues, and Dave Lanfear did letters and design for us, and Dave's just he does letters, design, and graphic design for, I think, just about every comic book made right now. So we were really great. It's really lucky to have him. So that's kind of the crew. We started out, I wanted to do a Moriarty story. It kind of just came to me one day because, you know, I wanted to do something Sherlock in that world, but I didn't want to do another Sherlock story.
You're coming in a proud tradition, I think, because M.J. Trow wrote the series of sort of semi-satirical pastiches that are starring Lestrade, and then you have the series of the Mycroft, you know, chronicles going on. And what you've done is really latched onto somebody who fascinates people because he's such a complete cipher. As you said, he's a total blank. We never see him. So it's a great plan. And so there's two existing, and then those came about also through Kickstarter, right?
We did a Kickstarter way in the beginning to, like, we were doing, I had this 4-issue story planned that I had written, and we had, I had to that point kind of like funded the work on some of our profit sales and whatnot. I needed to get a few more issues in the can. We did a Kickstarter to raise a little bit of money. And so we had our first few issues together, and then Image Comics came into the picture. And I spent like 2 years just shopping the project. Like, we had made a little preview book with 10 pages done and like a basic story pitch. I gave one of these to everybody, and just had so many meetings, went to all the conventions. After about 2 years of hard work, Image Comics finally came around, and they're like, hey, we're interested in this. And then about a year later, we signed the contracts, and the series started coming out in May of 2011. And for those who don't know, Image Comics is like the biggest deal indie comic book publisher in the entire world. They publish Walking Dead, so I think everybody's heard of that by now.
Yes.
Yeah, so, yeah. And Spawn, and they have, like, Saga and Fatale and a lot of other great series going right now. So we were just very blessed and fortunate to be picked up by them. So, yeah, so first it started off as a guerrilla operation and a Kickstarter, got picked up by Image. We did 2 volumes of stories. So basically, like, the first story was called The Dark Chamber. It was 4, like, kind of big-sized issues that were collected into a soft cover trade. Volume 1, The Dark Chamber, Moriarty, The Dark Chamber, and then the second trade was called Moriarty of the Lazarus Tree. That was 5 issues, and we collected that into a soft cover. And then those 2 books have been compiled together into the Moriarty Deluxe Edition hardcover that came out in June. And I can get more into those individual stories in a minute, but just to get back to the Kickstarter stuff, right now we are doing a Kickstarter to raise money for a Volume 3 story. Because like the way Independence Comics work is you basically fund everything up front, and you give them the finished product, and then they put it out, they distribute it. And the upside is that the creators get to keep all the creative rights. So that's why you go to all the trouble. So that's why they're a good company to work with. But right now we are running a Kickstarter, and it runs through October 31st. So if you're hearing this before October 31st, 2013, you can pledge. That's Halloween Day. It closes down at 3 p.m. October 31st. So just search for Moriarty Returns. If you go to Kickstarter.com, search for Moriarty Returns, and you'll find us. We're looking to raise some money so we can do a Volume 3 story. So basically that will be 4 more individual floppy issues, which will hit shops monthly. And then on that 5th month, you'll get the collected graphic novel trade, which will be the Volume 3. So that's what we're doing. We're working towards. I have it written right now. We got to get it drawn, get it produced, get it printed, get it distributed. So if anybody's listening right now, please consider running over to Moriarty Returns on Kickstarter and pledging your support. We got a lot of great incentives. You can catch up on the series if you pledge. Some of the prize tiers have the other books, so you could read everything and then read Blind Free when it comes out. But we got a lot of good stuff. We got artwork from Anthony. Anthony will draw some artwork for you. I can do a script consulting session with you if you're a writer. A lot of good prizes being offered, so just check out Moriarty Returns. So,
that's killer. I mean, yeah. It's when you're doing a Kickstarter, you have to, offer incentives that people actually want, and I think you've done a great job with that.
Cool. Thanks.
So yeah, absolutely. So I know that Sarah, you've read the Moriarty comics, yeah?
Yes, I finished the first one at 1 a.m. last night and the other one over lunch today.
Oh, wow.
But I got all the way through.
Great. Well, thank you for cramming and getting ready for for today. Yeah, yeah. So I hope you liked them.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
I just want to know, I have read, I read today The Lazarus Tree because I wanted also to have some background. I found it totally an interesting and really beautiful and well done read. And Sarah, since you've read both of them, I'm just curious, do you have any questions about, the world of the canon, the world of, that Daniel's creating or?
Yeah. One thing I noticed, in canon, Moriarty is referred to as a professor of mathematics, but his major work is on astrophysics.
Yes.
So you kind of had a choice there of what to do with him, and you went for the physics. Mm-hmm. Was that just because of the type of story you wanted to tell with the physics and the dark matter and the subatomic stuff?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Or was it just something? Why did you make that choice? Because I think it was a good one, an interesting one.
Oh, thanks. Well, it was central to his character, I think. So what I do when I go to write a story, most of the time I'll write a monologue for the lead character, because I think of a story like a character is the story, So who he is forms what the story is, and everything that happens is relative to who he is as a human being, right? So thinking of Professor Moriarty as being this guy that has constantly got to be one step ahead of everybody, has constantly got to, be on the jump, be smarter than everyone. This would be a guy that would be very interested in what it is that makes up the universe. He knows what forms everything. He kind of has an idea of how, how matter is bonded together. What is out in space? What is dark matter? What are things that are only theoretical? We don't even know about. He's got to know about all of that because he's got to be one jump ahead of everybody because he has to have an understanding of everything.
Apparently, dynamics of an asteroid was completely incomprehensible to everyone who tried to read it or review it. So right. Yes, you're. Right. I think you're totally justified.
Yeah, so either he's like more brilliant than everybody or he's crazy. So, but in my estimation, he's just more brilliant than everybody.
Why not both? Why not both?
A little of each. Yeah. So, but in the Lazarus Tree, especially, for those who haven't read it, he goes to, it's the second adventure. He goes to Burma to seek out an old colleague and to try to rebuild he's working on rebuilding his empire at this point. Yeah, there's this kind of heart of darkness moment where it's he and Officer Blair, a.k.a. George Orwell, are kind of going down, the dark river into the jungle together. And, he's contemplating all this stuff of theoretical physics and dark matter and all of this. And really what it's all tied up into is a sense of his own mortality, as he's getting older. And our story takes place 20 years after Reichenbach Falls. And he's survived, and Sherlock is, out of the picture, and we're not sure what's up, if he's dead or what. But Moriarty's getting a real sense of his own mortality, and things that most of us probably think of early in life, he's just now starting to consider, what's going to happen after I die, what's, you know, what happens when the energy goes away? You know, do we dissipate out into the universe? Is there another life? What happens, you know? So that's where all that contemplation of physics comes from. And he doesn't really want to admit it. George Orwell kind of calls him out on that a little bit. It's like, you're not really like thinking about God and stuff, are you? Moriarty kind of gives him a dirty look. But anyways, yeah, all of that stuff is wrapped up in who he is as a person. All of his studies, all of his physics and mathematics, it all has to do with who he is as a human being and who he is in this world and relative to the universe and to everything. So,
absolutely. And thank you for segueing into something that I really wanted to talk about, because you mentioned now Joseph Conrad, you mentioned Heart of Darkness, you mentioned this journey that they're taking through unmapped territory. And I was curious, reading it, whether this sort of, you know, you bring in the East India Company, you bring in colonialism, Watson doesn't come off very well when you bring in so there's a sort of reverse, casting going on here. And I'm curious, it seems very true to the canon, even though it's reversed cast in a certain sense, which is that the sort of, can I call it exoticism? The colonial exoticism is intact, but the chessboard has been reversed. So can you comment on that?
I love that description. That's beautiful. Thank you. Yeah, that's the thing. Like, when the new adaptations became popular, you know, as far as when we started first learning about Sherlock here in the States, and the Robert Downey Jr. movies came out, we were talking with some of my coworkers, and they were saying Sherlock Holmes isn't supposed to, like, you know, get into fights and run and jump and crazy stuff. And I'm like, wait a minute. So you haven't really read the stories, have you? We've got, you know, murderers and cult people from Afghanistan and faraway lands and secret symbols and handshakes and boat chases across the Thames and
just with blow darts.
Yeah, I know. It's like, it's everything that is adventure and wonder is in Sherlock Holmes. You know, it's almost like, you know, in a way, I was just thinking there's parallels to Indiana Jones in that we think of Indiana Jones as being the embodiment of adventure. Sherlock is too, you know?
Is the 19th century Indiana Jones, without doubt.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
We called it about 13 to 10 New York City time. Sherlock Holmes is the 19th century Indiana Jones.
Write it down. But so all of those elements I brought in, like in the Dark Chamber storyline, like we bring in, you know, a ninja clan, and the leading lady is a ninja assassin, you know. I wanted there to be an Asian flair because, you know, there's an Asian community in London at the time, you know, and now, obviously. And, there's your exoticism there. And then let's go to Burma and hang out with George Orwell. And so then we're going to bring in all the stuff that he writes about in Burmese days. So we're mixing up some of that literature with Sherlock Holmes lore. And we're also throwing in this visions of a mystical tree and an Indiana Jones style, you know, temple at the end of the story. And that goes along with what I understand as being in the background of all the Sherlock Holmes stories is, you know, adventure and exotic faraway locations. And yeah.
Is there a difference to your mind between incorporating something that can be sort of termed exoticism today into comic books that are being written today that, you know, obviously as many characters as are represented from as many ethnicities and as many, you know, orientations and as many cultures as is possible is a good thing. I mean, to what extent do you incorporate that? Is there something in the back of your head that says, don't exploit it? I mean, the way that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle wasn't, I don't think, intentionally aware of the fact that he was doing what Shakespeare did and all the bad guys are sort of set out of town. Oh, they're Italian, you know, they'll do. But to what extent, I guess my question is, to what extent does a modern sensibility play into this? Because, you know, you have readers of color, you're going to have tons of them. Can you comment on that aspect of it? Because, you know, I haven't studied the text to a sufficient extent to to do anything but ask.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in our stories, the bad guys are all, I mean, I can't say that I sat down and thought this out. I need to be as politically correct as possible. I can't tell you that I actually sat down and thought that out. But the bad guys are all white British guys. I mean, when we go to Burma, there's a local corrupt politician who's Burmese, you know, but really it's this government conspiracy that's in the background, this British government conspiracy. They've come in, they've looted the land, and they're, you know, trying to take away the treasures from the people, you know. So I guess, you know, I'm influenced by the writing of Orwell. I mean, I mix so many things together, just stuff that I like into these stories in a way that I think ended up making sense. But, you know, that's the Orwell influence on these stories, is that, you know, this idea of the British colonialism, you know, being, you know, they front it. They're doing, being noble and bold, and that they're trying to help the world by civilizing everybody, but it's really not a good thing. And you know, I do look at things, I think, in the book through a kind of a 2013 lens in that respect. Yeah, I don't know. Is that kind of answer your question, or do you have more questions about that? Because this is interesting. Nobody's ever asked me about that before.
No, I was just curious, because you're going to inevitably be looking at it through a different lens than Arthur Conan Doyle was, because if Sir Arthur Conan Doyle is writing, you know, Tonga, and Tonga is completely impossible. no such people existed. But yeah. Tonga is going to be shooting blow darts at people. That's Sir Arthur Conan Doyle filling in gaps in his map. And so I was interested that you moved to Burma with the character of Professor Moriarty, because you're echoing parts of the canon, but now we're now. So
right, yeah.
Does that make sense?
It does. It does. No, it's very interesting. Yeah, it's a very interesting point discussion to bring up. You know, there's stuff about it that I wanted to be very then, and stuff about it I kind of just wanted to be very now, I suppose. You know, and that when we portray historical, you know, periods and in figures and stuff, we always, you know, in today, we want to look at today in context of history, right? That had a lot to do with why I, in The Dark Chamber, the first story, you know, a major catalyst of the story is the fact that World War I is breaking out.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, well, that's something everybody can identify with. And we got, you know, the prospect of war and the panic, and Moriarty walking through the streets, and people are protesting with signs, and, you know, and they got some crazy people saying the end is coming and all this. Well, you know, that kind of stuff happens, but also portraying it in that particular way, being so extreme, is something that we can identify with, and it brings people into the story, I think. I learned a valuable lesson once from a mentor that I work with. His name is Ken Yulo, and he's Eugene O'Neill award-winning playwright, New York Times best-selling novelist. And I was working on a play once, and it was a play about a man who's a college professor and dealing with his father and the memory of his father who's passed away. And at one point, Ken said to me, why isn't this guy Einstein? Like, I'm like, you mean like he's really smart? He's like, no, I mean actually Einstein himself. And the point he was making was, give us something that we understand, you know, that we can kind of latch onto. You know, it's like he wasn't quite catching and empathizing with the character in the story. It's like bringing something real. So that's more like, I'm going to do a Moriarty story. I'm going to set it against the backdrop of World War I, because it's something real that people can understand. So, yeah.
You're talking about iconography and about myth-making and that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah.
You're right. People latch on to – it's when you subvert the iconography that things get interesting, which is why I think that what you've done with Moriarty is a great idea. It is such a fertile playing ground, I would imagine, for you to just sort of, you know, wander around it.
Yeah, you know, it was so much fun. I mean, and just creating the character of the professor. I mean, anybody that writes Professor Moriarty is going to be, you know, basically recreating the character in an image that they see fit. Because, you know, like I was saying before, and we were talking about, you know, he was really just an idea in the original canon. So But, you know, this was, this for me, was like, hey, let's make him the protagonist. Let's make him the leading man. He's got to be a fully fleshed out, understandable, capable of empathy human being. And, you know, I'm just like, why hasn't anybody done this in a comic book before? It's so much, this is amazing. It's so much fun.
Try to pick
apart this man's mind and try to figure out what his motivations are, what propels him, what puts him, makes him get through the day, you know?
You are so correct about that. I mean, it's a great playground. I'm curious. So Moriarty incarnations are myriad, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Could we go through, like, the Babes present as well and talk about Moriarty incarnations that are particularly inspiring? Because I had one or two questions off the internet for you, Daniel.
Okay.
And we have plenty to talk about, but in terms of incarnations of Moriarty and how you feel like that person best embodied him, when you're talking about backstory, obviously Conan Doyle gave him nothing. And I have bitched about this for way too long podcast, so I'm not going to bitch about it now. Like, single podcast you do, I'm like, Moriarty. So I'm not going to do it again, I promise. Dear listeners.
Thank goodness.
But I mean, like, let's go left to right on my screen. So, Sarah, if you could comment on Moriarty that you have found, either sympathetic or particularly effective.
Oh, gosh. I don't know.
What are some of your favorite adaptations that include him?
Well, Jeremy Brett was my first Holmes, so that was...
Oh, he's great.
Yeah, he's great. But
Eric Porter?
Eric Porter, yeah.
It's so brief. The thing I remember most about that episode is actually Watson breaking down in tears. But yes, he's very effective there. And I actually did very much like Andrew Scott. It's obviously a different take on the character, different situation, but I thought he was very effective in that setting.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They had a very specific kind of language and world that, yeah, he fit very well into that.
Eric Porter, my God, I mean, he looks just like him, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the original sketch drawings.
Oh, yeah.
I don't want to be mean to Eric Porter. handsome piece of man flesh. But man alive! Fuck, he looks like the he's perfect. And just the way they costumed him and everything. Well, obviously, they were doing pageant recreations throughout the Granada series. But thank you for bringing up Eric Porter, sir.
Yeah.
He's awesome. Mel, do you have Moriarty feelings?
I do. I would think that, in terms of like the kind of classical Moriarty that we've seen a million times, I think the guy who did it best was Jared Harris. He was highly menacing while still being, he seemed to have the mental capacity that you expect from Moriarty, but he wasn't so thin and frail that he wouldn't stand a chance against Sherlock Holmes. Like, they seemed very evenly matched, which is why I thought their final fight scene was, you know, very effective.
You mean it was written better than the Doyle story?
Yeah, I wouldn't put it in that way. I wouldn't put it in that many words, but yes, it was exactly written much better than the Doyle story. I mean, Doyle was clearly done and just said, you know, fuck it, like, let's get rid of this guy, you know. But in terms of my favorite Moriarty, that would definitely be Andrew Scott. And I didn't like him at first. I thought that he was maybe a little too playful, a little too sing-songy. He didn't terrify me in the beginning. And then what happened was during the scene where he is Richard Brooke, he actually had me going. And he had me going for about a minute. I was like, oh my God, where's this series going with this? And then once I realized what was happening, then for the first time ever with any portrayal of Moriarty, I felt fear. Actual fear that he was going to be able to pull it off and that Sherlock's life was going to be completely ruined.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
God, he's just so absent in these really key moments. where, you know, you're thinking you're looking at a person, and he's just layering on personalities like they're coats. He's scary as all get out. But Melinda, I mean, comment on, what's his name? Daniel Davis? I think it's Daniel Davis.
Yes, from Star Trek The Next Generation.
I would love to. So Daniel Davis was my first Moriarty because Data was my first Sherlock Holmes. And I remember what stuck out the most about his portrayal to me was his haircut. I thought it was absolutely awful. The costuming for that episode was really good, but the haircut was a little distracting.
It was the 80s.
Exactly. It was future 80s.
Yes.
I really liked that instead he became a very three-dimensional character. I get it. He's on holodeck. He became a very three-dimensional character at the end of it because you know, obviously he'd been created as someone who could defeat Data rather than defeating Sherlock Holmes. And as such, I was very sorry to see him go because he'd become a completely different character by the end of the episode. And I think Picard would agree with me on that.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, that's for me, that was a really big deal, too. And as I go back and rewatch that episode again, I watched it again very recently. There's such a sense of vulnerability about him. And the fact that he's actually in an existential crisis, you know, in a science fiction kind of setting, but in a way that we as people can watch and identify with, you know, when somebody suddenly discovers that the, you know, everything that they're living is a lie, and that the truth is really, you know, something else, you know, and he has this, but he charges headlong into it, you know, as a person of discovery, you know. It's like this world that I thought was real isn't, but there's something else out there, and I want to know what it is rather than retreating back and, you know, cowering away and withering away and weeping and whining about it. You know, there's that Doyle sense of adventure that was, you know, expressed in that episode, and that was really wonderful. And that was when Anthony was drawing our Moriarty, he really latched onto that guy too, you know, to Daniel Davis, because that was his first Moriarty, and he had all the same thoughts about him too. You know? It was like, oh, there was such a sense of vulnerability, but about this guy, you know, yeah. And it was like he had this sense of a leading man about him, rather than just the crazy guy that kind of shows up and giggles a little, you know. But that's wonderful too, and you know, it's a different take on things. But yeah, that's when we kind of saw him. That's the only time I've seen him in anything really where he was kind of had a leading man sensibility, and that he had a quest. He had a, you know, a desire and a want for something that we as everyday humans can really empathize with. So
were there any portrayals of Moriarty that you used, that you kept in mind while creating yours? Or did you really start with a fresh slate just because this is a guy who has no background information?
You know, I mean, I got all that from the Daniel Davis, portrayal, all the stuff I was just talking about. But when I was really starting from the very, very beginning, really from scratch, I was thinking of him more in terms of almost, you know, an American hard-boiled detective character. So I was thinking of him almost a little more like Philip Marlowe,
oh
you
my
know.
God. Cool.
So, and if you read the first volume story, the first issue of the Dark Chamber, when we see him in the beginning, he's very down and out. He has a cruddy little office in a cruddy part of town. He hangs out at this bar. You know, there's the sending and receiving of telegrams and secret messages, which was really inspired by a Dashiell Hammett novel called The Glass Key, where three quarters of that book have Ned Beaumont, the lead character, the sending and receiving of secret telegrams from anonymous people and stuff, it plays huge in that story. And but anyways, yeah, so those elements of just like Chandler and Hammett really kind of played a lot in the beginning in the creation of this character. So that really had a lot to do with it. But thinking about that kind of guy relative to Sherlock Holmes, relative to actually being Sir Professor Moriarty, is kind of where he came from. So yeah.
Can you talk about his actual relation to Sherlock Holmes in your adaptation? Because it's definitely different.
Yeah.
So just comment on what his relationship is to Sherlock Holmes in the world of your, you know, comic series.
Okay, that would be all awesome. Right. Well, I think of them in terms of being, you know, and this is something that everybody probably thinks of, but, you know, they're kind of the same guy. They just kind of follow on different lines. You know, in a way, it's kind of like in I'm just going to keep making pop culture references, and you're going to and people that are listening to this are going to think this story's crazy. It's all over the place, but really isn't. It's really very focused. These are just the things that influenced me. But then the movie Heat, you got, you know, Pacino and De Niro. Pacino as the hard boiled cop, De Niro as this, you know, so loner, stick up man. They're really kind of the same guy. They just kind of happen to fall on different sides of the law. And that's kind of.
You're talking about, like, you know, Darkwing Duck and Mega Duck.
Am I? You know, it's funny because, you know, Anthony was a big Darkwing Duck fan. Anthony Diacidua, my artist. So
who is a big Darkwing Duck fan?
Yeah. I don't remember it as well as he does or as you do, but yeah, it's pretty great.
Like, you know, my double, my brother, at the same time that it's my enemy, my adversary.
Right, yeah. So he doesn't realize until Sherlock is gone that that's his meaning in life, is, you know, going after Holmes, you know. This is kind of what really inspires him to do what he does. And these two guys, they just – the reason they fell on the lines that they did is because they just happened to be in circumstances that served those particular needs, you know. Sherlock just happened to fall in with law enforcement, I think. And, you know, he loves solving puzzles. He loves being ahead of the game. He loves the game. He loves the chase. But he happened to fall in with law enforcement, and he was good use to them. And he ended up – that's how he kind of gets his natural high, is helping the police, being on the side of law and order. So, you know, there's a sense of goodness about that. But it's also just has to do with what he wants as a human being, you know, and that is to be engaged in the chase. And Moriarty – as I imagine him, has a very, very, very bad childhood and upbringing. You know, I imagine – I don't give – because I have stuff I want to do in future stories, so I don't want to give too much away. He just fell in with a bad element. He's got all the same wants and needs for, you know, the chase, the prize, the adventure that Holmes does. But he grew up on the street, you know, in the bad elements, and that's how he learned how to get that Jones going, was by committing crimes, you know, by being on the other side. You know, he fell in with the gangs instead, whereas Sherlock's gang was the cops. Moriarty's gang was the, you know, the racketeers and the criminals. So that's kind of how I see them. You know, they part ways very quickly in our adaptation, because the first three issues, I mean, the first three pages of volume one, The Dark Chamber, we see Reichenbach Falls, and things turn out very differently than we've heard, you know. Right. You know, Moriarty emerges as the victor, and you know, it's an alternate history, you know, to what we know. Moriarty emerges as the victor from Reichenbach Falls, and 20 years go by, World War I's breaking out, and he has just completely lost all meaning in life, you know. So in that 20 years that have gone by, he has done nothing. He's lost his criminal empire, he's lost all of his henchmen, he's lost all of his he's lost all of his money, all of his businesses that he owned. And yeah, he's basically kind of like living like Philip Marlowe in a cruddy office, taking little jobs, you know. You know, in a sense, in a way, he's kind of like – he has kind of become Sherlock Holmes, in that he is the detective now, creeping by. But, you know, it's not really the same.
I love it. And the fact that Sherlock Holmes in, you know, the if you're going to look at it canonically, he laments Moriarty being dead.
Mm-hmm.
It's a not very effective repartee with Watson a couple times, where he's like, oh god, if only Professor Moriarty's here. I mean, yeah. It would be so much more interesting. Life, blah, life.
Yeah,
right. Watson's like...
Yeah, it's like when you get to the end of a great book and you're just like, why did I spend all this time getting to the end of this, because now it's over. Like, it's lost a little bit of meaning now that I'm not reading this book, you know.
That's exactly what happened to Sherlock Holmes in the original canon, and that's what you have made happen to Moriarty in your adaptation, which I think is pretty brilliant in terms of the role reversal, because it is also something I think in the BBC version that they did really effectively, that I love Jared Harris in Guy Ritchie Warner Brothers adaptations, but I think one thing they did in the BBC version that was just maybe a little bit more, I don't know, just a touch more clear in terms of drawing certain lines, was that Moriarty needs Sherlock Holmes as much as Sherlock Holmes needs Moriarty to provide him challenges. So they want to be challenged by each other. And this sort of vision of a down and out Moriarty who is post Sherlock Holmes and just sad about it is
very believable.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. That's an interesting, the scene that they do in the Reichenbach Fall in the BBC version. I really like that. That mirrors the scene from the Final Problem in the original canon, where they meet in Sherlock's flat and they're drinking tea, and you know, and Moriarty says to him, "Well, that's the final problem," you know. you know, it's just the sense of these guys are looking at each other, and it's like it's the end of the universe as we know it. It's the end of the world. It's the end of all existence. These guys are like, we're gonna have to, one of us will die or both of us will die, and it's gonna be the end of everything. But there's no, you know, it's like if you're going to read a great book, you got to get to the end of it, you know, so it's inevitable,
They're kind of avatars for all of us, you know, whichever side you're on. They're sort of, they're beautifully drawn and they're very detailed and they're explicitly, you know, written in terms of this is great storytelling, but they're kind of avatars for everyone in the sense that this is like down and out good versus evil, but it only works if the people involved are conflicted about it.
Right. And, you know, that goes into, for me, goes into Moriarty's sense of, you know, the mathematics and the astrophysics and the considering of life and the universe and all that we know it. So those, like, in that scene in the original canon and in that Sherlock show, I think picks that in because, you know, there's something very huge and universal and mythic about the struggle that they're encountering. And they know it because they have, these guys are smart enough to have that kind of self-awareness. But yeah, and I wanted to play that out in my version with Moriarty being this guy that thinks the biggest thoughts that anybody's ever thought, because you know he's kind of on the edge of the universe. This is, you know, the biggest person, the biggest mind that's ever lived to me. So
yeah, I love the concept. So can I ask again the panel? I found a very interesting quote from Daniel, which I thought was so like ripe for, you know, discussion and very, very apt.
Okay. I'm getting nervous now. I guess I have a quote from Daniel. It was so stupid. No.
I think it's very, very, very cool. So he said in the introduction to the first comic, I believe, there was a brief explication you did on the character of Professor Moriarty just, you know, at the beginning. Yeah. And so if I could take a quiz of the Bay's present, and then we could talk to Daniel about this, because I think it's absolutely like a fabulous observation. He said that popular culture, to a certain extent, created Moriarty. And I think that that is a pretty legit observation, because Moriarty, we don't see him ever physically once in the Sherlock Holmes mysteries. So to what extent do you guys think that we want a good old-fashioned villain in terms of the way the BBC adapted it, the way Warner Brothers adapted it, with a good old-fashioned villain who you can really hate and you just want to, you know, like, take that person by the lapels and, like, latch onto them?
Well, because Conan Doyle gave us almost nothing to work on, I think I'd be really interested in seeing how some of the earliest portrayals of Moriarty in film and stage would have looked like, because we've got a, you know, the single scene of him arriving in Baker Street, menacing Holmes and instantly deducing things about him in the way that Holmes normally does with his clients, asking him to remove the revolver from his dressing gown, things like that. What little inference that we can get from there would be that, you know, everything that Holmes has told us about this man is absolutely true, that he is his intellectual superior, that he's extremely dangerous, that he's well connected, and, you know, as a result, just an extremely dangerous man. But because we are only given that one conversation with him, as opposed to, you know, them seeing him like running up onto a train platform or something like that, which really isn't a scene with Moriarty in it at all, I would think that sort of the first couple of attempts are going to try and stick with that little bit that we've been given, which has been the Moriarty that we've been looking at for a really long time, and the one that I think everyone's a little bit bored with.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I liked so much about what BBC decided to do with the character is they got rid of all the old stereotypes about Moriarty that we've been holding on to for a really long time. Instead of having this, you know, tall, looming, sinister figure who's, you know, kind of very serious and every bit the professor, they just kind of tossed it on its head because, you know, why not? The character needed some shaking up in order to be effective today. Where was I going with this? I had a point, and I lost it.
Well, I think you were doing a job there. You were talking about how popular culture has maybe changed the character, because the way he was probably presented to us originally was maybe a little stodgy, a little stuffy by today's standards.
Right, but in that case, then I would say that pop culture is probably changing Sherlock Holmes in the same way that it's changing Moriarty. These past couple of Holmeses that we've gotten have been extremely fresh and brand new takes, just like the last three Moriartys that we've gotten have been Jared Harris, who we already talked about, Andrew Scott, who I think is probably the most unique portrayal that I've ever seen of the character, the most different from the previous incarnations.
Definitely.
And then we have the one from Elementary, which is doing the same thing, just kind of taking everything that we knew about this character and throwing it away.
Right.
Moriarty has changed more than Sherlock Holmes has, maybe in that regard. The ones that we're getting now are obviously updated and modern and fresh and new, and they translate very well to modern day. But we had more to go on. We knew more about this guy. We knew that he had, you know, multiple talents in multiple areas. We knew that he was really smart. He could investigate. He stayed current with technology in those days, you know, just even the fingerprints, which, by the way, I think the comment, I've heard something of the kind, when he found the fingerprint on the wall, was definitely a bit of sarcasm that some people have overlooked.
Oh, the Norwood Builder bit?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think he said, I've heard something of the kind about fingerprints being unique, and I'm like, oh, God. Yeah, totally. So because we had so much source material with Sherlock Holmes, and we had next to nothing with Moriarty, people aren't going, I don't think... I think that people aren't going to get as butthurt if something happens with the character that isn't what they had anticipated happening with the character. You can take a lot more liberties with Moriarty than you can with Sherlock Holmes, and you will offend almost nobody.
Yeah, what do you have to lose? Mm-hmm. He was a dude who went by on a train. Did popular culture create the legend of Professor Moriarty, or I would add this to the question, or did the death of Sherlock Holmes create the legend of Moriarty? Because I don't think any of us would be talking about him if he hadn't killed Sherlock Holmes, personally, because we didn't see him. So
it's a good point. I think if he was just another bad guy, he would be just another bad guy. Like Melinda said, it would be interesting to look back and see the different portrayals from early on, if he is sort of your generic mustache-twirling villain who now evolves into someone with his own bank-robbing smartphone app.
It's interesting to me because the style is impeccable. When Conan Doyle sat down and wrote The Napoleon of Crime, I mean, my God, that's just... It's so sexy. It's like,
shivers going down your spine when you read the Napoleon of Crime.
Napoleon of Crime that he never mentioned to Watson before.
Yeah, oh, hey.
Yeah, by the way.
That's the thing I always bitch about on these podcasts.
I was listening to, I tell you, I was brushing up for this, and I listened to several shows yesterday, and I believe you said, you talked about, you did mention that on one of the shows that I heard yesterday was, you said, oh, by the way, did I ever mention my greatest enemy ever?
Please, whoever's editing this, edit all of that out. But the...
No,
don't edit you out. Edit out all of my bitching about the final problem. But not to mention the empty house, please. You can't reverse these. Come on. Point, I think, with popular culture creating Professor Moriarty is that he actually enabled the hero to die and to come back from the dead. And so this is the character who's selected for this project. For whatever reason, Conan Doyle said, I can't stand Sherlock Holmes anymore. I'm not physically capable of it. I'm going to kill him. And then he wrote a short story in reverse, which is, have you ever heard of my arch nemesis?
Nope.
What? What? I don't know what you're talking about. It was like opposite day for.
So are you saying that he's sort of like a Judas figure, yeah, where he has a role to fill, or he has a role to play, mm-hmm, and without him playing that part, the ultimate sacrifice can't be made.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
That's a wonderful analogy.
Age.
I love that.
Would have said if I was smart enough to make that metaphor, but thank you, Melinda. That is exactly what I was saying. The ultimate sacrifice would not have been made if not for this character being created, who then got turned into a pop culture phenomenon because of the fact that he made this happen. I mean, we only know about Judas and 30 pieces of silver for the same reason, mythologically speaking.
Yeah, it goes back to what I was saying at the beginning. You know, the reason I put that in that intro to the first volume was, that pop culture has kind of, you know, elevated him and kind of created him. And it goes back to what I was saying before. It was like, I think people have a need to understand what's going on. And this, people really glom onto this idea that there's one guy out there doing everything bad.
Yeah.
And like I said, I think that inspires a goodness in us, mm-hmm, and that we feel that we can overcome if we understand what the badness is. If we understand the darkness, then we know the light.
That is extremely resonant. Yeah.
Wow. Thank you.
No, I just think that that's part of the reason we read hero stories, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I have this overdeveloped sense of justice, for my love of superheroes and stuff as a kid and comics and all that. So I really get into that sort of thing, what we're talking about here. So anyways.
I found another great quote from Daniel.
Oh. Yes.
So he talked about for a minute how in again, his awesome introduction to the series, how the Sherlock Holmes mysteries are considered to be great literature, and they are, but they are also great pulp. And I would agree with that 900% if that was the percentage that was actually possible. So, because Sherlock Holmes belongs to everyone, and he always has. But in terms of reading things like Superman and watching Star Trek, and going to the next Batman movie and reading the Sherlock Holmes mysteries, and the fact that they're not only so well written that of course the Sherlock Holmes mysteries are literature, mm-hmm, but they are also pulp in the sense that everyone gets it. Mm-hmm. And everyone knows that Sherlock Holmes' moral compass, while sort of dependent on John Watson's occasionally, is the one that you're paying attention to.
Mm-hmm.
Can you comment on literature versus pulp? And I know that's a giant question, but mm-hmm, you seem perfectly capable. So 3, 2, 1, go.
So I have a question that maybe you can answer, Lindsay. What's the criteria for literature and for pulp?
Well, you asked a great question, and I would say that...
Why, thank you.
That the distinctions are arbitrary.
Mm-hmm.
So when I say the distinctions are arbitrary, that means there is no difference, I think, between Lolita and, you know, okay, so there's a certain level of skill set involved, right, when you're working on something, but I don't think that there's any difference between writing Beowulf and writing Sherlock Holmes. And at the time, Sherlock Holmes was published in the equivalent of Reader's Digest. It was not considered great literature. Even today, it is, you know, the most popular, probably the most recognized, apart from, I think, Jesus and Santa Claus character in the entire world. And it's definitely considered literature, but it belongs to everyone. Sherlock Holmes is everyone. So I guess I'm asking the question, since Daniel said it's both literature and pulp, and I agree with that, pulp is sort of, you know, considered the trash fiction of the masses, and literature is navel-gazing moment of truth, Jonathan Franzen shit. And I
want
people to comment because I think that paradigm is bullshit.
So I used to think that the difference between pulp and literature was subject matter, but we can, you know, we can compare Dracula with Twilight and see that that's not that doesn't necessarily work in every case. I would think that most detective stories fall into the pulp category. Even the other detectives that I'm extremely fond of, like Agatha Christie's Hercule Poirot, I can't call that great literature as much as I love them, because while the writing is lively and the characters are entertaining and the plots keep me interested throughout the book, they don't have that kind of subtle artistry that Watson brings to every single page. Not every single page, of course. You know, I've read some terrible stories, but when he gets it right, he does it in a way that I haven't seen before in any other type of literature. And just because the format happens to be accessible, that there are short stories that were appearing in Reader's Digest, I don't think that lowers it to the level of pulp. Just like I do think that, well, I mean, people already do think, but the Harry Potter series, I do think is going to be classic literature.
Yeah.
It is, but it's sort of in the same category where you look at it and it's like, this is too easy and too enjoyable to read. Therefore, it can't be literature because, you know, there's no reason why a classic should be enjoyable. It should be something that you suffer through, like Great Expectations or Sound and the Fury. You know? Burn on both of those books, by the way. Burn. I couldn't stand them. But the Harry Potter series, I read them like they were going out of style. I couldn't get enough of them. And there's just no doubt in my mind that those are going to be viewed very favorably, like 100 years from now. As to what it is about the Sherlock Holmes stories that elevates it, I would just have to say it's got to be the beautiful writing style, the beautiful prose.
Yep, writer at the center of the web.
Yeah, I like what you said about it being arbitrary as far as what's literature, what's pulp, you know, because like, I don't think that pulp means that it's, you know, subpar or something. I mean, the great American novels of the 20th century. You know, Red Harvest, are you going to say that that's garbage? No. Yeah. So, you know, it's pulp, but it's a great classic. You know, it's a classic work of American artistry, you know? And yeah, I mean, cause like, you know, we would call Sherlock Holmes literature cause the writing is beautiful. It has a certain, you know, it has a certain elevated sense to it, you know, but when you really look at it, it's all the stuff I said, you know, it's boat chases across the Thames and guys with blowguns and, you know, trips to Afghanistan. And, fun, cool stuff, cool adventure, you know? So it's the adventure aspect of it and whatnot that would make it pulp. But yeah, the whole thing's arbitrary as far as pulp literature. And, you know, it goes back to, was it Lou Armstrong talking about jazz? It's like, what is jazz? Man, if I got to tell you, you never know. So, I said that to say, basically, we could at both times think of these stories as being great and being fun.
Yeah.
So that's, I think that's basically what I meant when I said that. So.
I think that you were absolutely right. And when did it happen that we had to suffer through great literature? I mean, what kind of Puritans are we, honestly? When did it happen that it had to be painful for you to get through a great book? You know, I mean,
yeah, I think, you know, in school, they should be reading. I mean, there's some hard stuff that the kids should read. OK, maybe.
Sure.
But, you know, mix in Sherlock Holmes in there, too.
Maybe,
you know?
We can make the Mormon chapters of Study in Scarlet the hard stuff.
Yes, I agree. That is the hard stuff.
That is the hard stuff.
Yeah. That would be a good compromise. You get half detective story and then half kind of
like, oh,
Boring historical epic. But yeah, that's a good one. But you know, thank goodness though, we do have some stuff like Huckleberry Finn, that would be in Tom Sawyer, whatever, you know, some of that great Mark Twain stuff that has adventure and fun in it, but is still considered by the upper crust to be great literature. So we can teach it in school. So thank goodness we have some of that stuff.
It all harks back to the fact that if you're reading fiction and you're inspired by reading any sort of fiction, and Neil Gaiman recently commented on this brilliantly, and you can find it by just, I think, Googling Neil Gaiman Guardian talk. That whole thing about libraries and he's brilliant. But he's like, there is no bad book for children. If children want to read something, give it to them. Just give it to them, because if you're interested and invested in reading as an activity, it doesn't matter. Hand them R.L. Stein. I mean, all of these brilliant writers have been vilified over certain periods of time for writing bad for children books. And this is a little bit off topic, but not exactly, because of the fact that I think that once a book has been around for long enough, there's a certain urge to sort of put it in the canon of Western literature, and Sherlock Holmes is definitely in the canon of Western literature. But what I appreciate so much about the commentary that you're making is that it is still extremely accessible. This is about snakes biting people. This is about, you know, like, beds being mysteriously fastened to the floor. This is about, you know, mysterious yellow faces in a window. This is about all sorts of, you know, to a certain extent, exotic, because Conan Doyle was coming from where he was coming from. But to another extent, adventurous and excited. And if you, you know, if you look at it, it was always meant to be an adventure when you were going along with Holmes and Watson for this, whatever journey they were on. It was meant to be exciting, and it was meant to be a journey. So when, you know, I'm not trying to belabor the point at all, but, and you can probably cut a bunch of this, but I don't.
No, every word is golden.
Leave it.
The distinction between, when I'm asking about the distinction between good literature and good pulp, I don't think there is a real distinction. And I think that you really nail that, because there shouldn't be one. And what is considered to be disgraceful at a particular period might later be considered to be Huck Finn or Sherlock Holmes. And I think that taking Moriarty and sort of reworking him into a protagonist is a really interesting way to shine another lens on that subject, and sort of, you know, like a shine a light and refocus the narrative to, you know, whatever you want to do with the protagonist, because it's always been about pop culture since Sherlock Holmes, you know, was conceived. And that's what you're doing with Well, correct me if I'm wrong. It seems like that's what you're doing with Moriarty as well, because he's turned into sort of a down and out pop culture protagonist in your comics, am I right?
Yeah, that was definitely part of my intention. Yeah.
And it comes across brilliantly. And like, do you mind commenting on how he turns into sort of more of a? I would love for you to talk a little bit more about him being Philip Marlowe, because like,
oh, okay,
as a sort of down and out pop culture protagonist, Moriarty in your you know adaptations. Mm-hmm. But like, if you could bring in a little bit of how you work the spiritual element into that, because you have a sort of supernatural, steampunky kind of like, if I were to add two condiments and shake them on your comic, it would be supernatural and then steampunk.
Yeah.
So, like, if I have a white pepper grinder and, you know, dried basil and steampunk, so talk about, like, how you took those, you know, genres and sort of, like, made them important to you and resonant to you and thus to your readers.
Well, you know, over the course of this conversation, I've cited many things that have influenced me as a person, as a writer. So, when I go to write this story, all that stuff kind of is, you know, part of my catalog and kind of goes into the story. So when I break it down, like I said before, when I started to, you know, first I was talking about Philip Marlowe, then I was talking about Keith, then I was like, people are going to think this is crazy. This book is going to be horrible and bad because he's pulling in everything in the universe and shoving it in here. And it sounds like it's going to be really dumb. No, it really works when you read it. You know, it makes sense, I promise. But yeah, there's just certain things that I identify with that, you know, a lot of people identify with that we see in popular culture. And, you know, I'll start off by saying I think that reading books and watching movies should make us better people. You know, I think that consuming art in any way should make us better people somehow. I come from the theater. Now, that's where I really started off, acting, directing, writing, and plays. And, I mean, I can't watch a play without thinking about eternity. So when I sit down to write anything, it doesn't matter what it is, I want people to think about themselves and their place in this world and the universe. And there's certain things that engage me in popular culture that make me do that. So, you know, the idea of the hard-boiled detective, you know, it's pretty American, in a way. You've got the angst-ridden guy.
Yeah.
Maybe a heavy drinker in a crappy office somewhere, you know. We don't really know where he's coming from. We don't really know what his angst is exactly, but it's what propels him into these dangerous and dark situations, you know. This is how he lives because this is who he is. So, you know, that was the origin of, you know, that was why I, you know, that sparks a sense of adventure in me, this idea of a hard-boiled detective. So that's why I said, oh, let's make him a hard-boiled detective. You know, putting it against the backdrop of a world war. You know, when I was a little kid, I was crazy watching war movies. That's all I wanted to see was war movies, spy movies, commandos, all of this, you know, Where Eagles Dare. You know, commando movie with Clint Eastwood and Richard Burton was like one of my favorite movies, based on an Alistair Lee novel. Mm-hmm. There was certain things in popular culture that I wanted to bring in because that sense of adventure sparks me as a human being. You know, it gives me the sense of wonder, which gives me a sense of, you know, I could be better than where I am right now. But yeah, you know, and all these genre elements, it's just stuff that I love, you know. I love swashbuckling sword fighting. I watched Captain Blood and all the great Errol Flynn movies when I was a kid. So that's why I wanted Moriarty to, you know, have a sword in his cane and to use it a lot. You know, and I wanted him to, you know, he looks like the skinny professor guy, but he could drink you under the table and he could whip your ass. So don't cross him. You know, and that's just, you know, what guy doesn't want to be that guy, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, and this, you know, and there's a high adventure aspect to him with all the gadgets and the airships and stuff like that, where that comes from, you know, James Bond and Indiana Jones. I don't know. I mean, I'm talking a lot and sounding a little pretentious maybe, but you know, that's just to give you a glimpse into just to who I am as a person. When I look at art, how that makes me a different person, how that changes me, that's what I wanted to put in the story, because I want other people to have that experience, because it's all about joy, you know?
Is it influenced by, yeah, it is all about joy, absolutely. Is it influenced for you by steampunk at all?
Yeah, you know, I'm not like a huge steampunk person. You know, I dig it, though. I'm around it a lot because, you know, I'm always at I go to these comic conventions all the time, and I'm always around the steampunk folks. And
it seemed a little steampunky.
Yeah. So it's definitely in there as an element of the story. You know, I wouldn't call it hardcore steampunk. It's definitely not that. But, you know, I'm like, I want to have these two guys sword fighting on top of a blimp. How steampunk is that? You know? Yeah. You know, I want to have a gigantic death ray machine, you know, powered by pistol turbines that, you know, shoots this laser beam that controls people's minds or whatever. You know, that's, you know, very steampunk. When you see that machine in the book, it's very steampunk. And so, you know, and it was a sense of bringing in some of this technology that's today and putting it back then inspires this kind of sense of wonderment, you know, about it. And that's what steampunk's kind of all about. So, yeah, absolutely. For me, I really love the whole thing. I really, my favorite is the Lazarus Tree, the second one. And that just has to do with all the stuff I've said this already. It has to do with the professor, you know, looking into the face of eternity. And I think when you go to the end of that story, you know, I experienced a moment of transcendence, just kind of like in a way that just it lifts my spirits to writing the end of that story. It really lifted me spiritually. And reading, I go back and read it a lot for some reason, as if somebody else wrote it. I enjoy it. First of all, for me, it's my favorite arc that Anthony's done in our series.
Oh, it's that, beautiful, yeah.
That last issue, the last chapter of the Lazarus Tree, I think he was just really on fire. You know, he had the whole series at that point to really build his style. And also, we were in a real rush to get on this, so he just really got in this mind space of doing it. It had to get done, and he did it. And he, anyways, it's the best artwork, and it's mesmerizing to me to look at it. I think he just did a wonderful job, Anthony did. And but yeah, the end of the story has the professor basically gazing into the face of eternity and making choices, and that's what I do every day. And I hope everybody in their own way does that too. And you know, I was hoping that writing that story would inspire people to think on those things. I don't know if we went totally off point here or what, but anyways, yeah.
No, not at all. I mean, I am curious, you know, since we sort of got into the mythology of Sherlock Holmes and Professor Moriarty and, you know, all of these influences that have affected you and, you know, questions about your work, is there anything that you'd like to say that we haven't covered? Or
the two stories that we did are very distinct, and so, you know, I hope everybody out there gets a chance to check them out. They're very distinct, but they're still part of the same series. You know, we got the professor in London in our volume one, the Dark Chamber story. We got him in London, kind of what you'd think of as a standard Sherlock Holmes type setting, but with a fantastical trappings from his fantastical machinery, fantastical high adventure that you might know from sources such as League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, you know?
Mm-hmm. If you could address that, we had a question from Twitter regarding League of Extraordinary mm-hmm. Gentlemen. And it, the person was curious whether or not that had influenced you at all, because that is one precedent of Moriarty being present in a comic mm-hmm. adaptation.
Yeah, well, you know, he's been present in any number of comics as the villain, you know? Sure.
Yeah.
No, I wouldn't say that. I actually, as I was working on this, I had not read that book yet. I saw the movie several years ago when that came out. Mm-hmm. As I was working on writing the script, I did read the comic at that point. I was kind of settled on what I was going to do. So I can't say that it influenced me other than, you know, just say, oh, this is mine's going to be a good companion piece to this, perhaps. If people like this, they'll like mine, you know. But I can't say that it influenced my storytelling. But yeah, but it, you know, I always love seeing Moriarty in something. It was wonderful seeing him. He kind of turns up as a surprise in the book, you know. So
yeah. Kind of an Easter egg, I think, in League.
Yeah, well, the League's all about Easter eggs. That's yeah. the whole gimmick of the League. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it was funny. Like my friend Jonathan London, who he's hosts the Geekscape podcast and website, and he was telling me, and like I said earlier, I love both the stories we did. I really liked Lazarus Tree. He was telling me, he's like, you know, the first one was really cool, The Dark Chamber, because it was all about finding the Sherlock Easter eggs, you know? But in the second one, Lazarus Tree, it's like, we're taking them to Burma. It's like, you can kind of do whatever you want, you know? So that's why I say the two stories are very distinct. So, you know, we get the professor into colonial Burma, into more of a George Orwell type setting and more of an Indiana Jones type setting. But yet he's still doing Sherlock style detective work, and he's doing autopsies and making deductions about these bodies that were killed in fantastical ways. And, you know, and we have a major character from the canon show up in a kind of a surprise thing, but I'll give everybody a hint. He's got a big gun, you know. So, yes, Sherlock Holmes. Yeah, there's still Sherlock Holmes in there.
He does have a big gun. He has an accurate gun.
Yes, absolutely. So, I guess what I'm saying is I just had so much fun telling these stories because, yeah, like I said, we were able to we built a world, you know, Anthony and I and the other guys for the professor, a world that's specific to us in the way we wanted to do a Sherlock Holmes lore. And then was like, hey, let's just tell whatever kind of story we want, but still have it identifiable as a Sherlock Holmes / Moriarty type mystery. And you know, I'm just getting excited and going on about it because it just gives me such joy. And like I said, I tell these stories because that's what they do for me, and I want them to inspire that kind of joy in other people. And when we get to doing the third volume of Moriarty, when we do our new story, we go to yet another exotic locale.
Ooh.
So and it's a completely other different type of story, you know. I don't want to drop too much yet because we're not ready to announce. But I will say the next story is more of a horror story.
Ah, I was just about to ask, can you give us a hint?
Yes, it is more of a horror story. More of like, so I'll just say that.
But you definitely have the supernatural element set up, and it's going to dovetail perfectly into what you've already been doing. And you reminded me a little bit of John le Carré's closing line at the, you know, introduction he did to Clingers. Annotated, which was something along the lines of, no one writes of Holmes and Watson without love. And I think that you are, you know, talking about that. Just
oh, wonderful. Yeah, well, you know, that's the central thing to all drama. You know, I think there are people in the world that are love deniers, and I feel sorry for them. You know what I mean?
Shame.
but what was that?
Yeah, what a shame for those folks.
Yeah, I know. They're missing out on everything that is life. And, you know, if you want to create art, love is at the center of it, you know, because art is about, you know, if you're talking about drama specifically, you know, writing novels, it's relationships is what it's all about. And there's always going to be degrees of love in any kind of relationship. And so that's a wonderful statement that le Carré said. And I think it's wonderful that you bring it up in a conversation about my book, because that makes me feel good. But if you're going to have Holmes and Watson or Moriarty, there has to be some kind of love. Yeah,
exactly. You have to love the characters first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I do love this guy. I do.
Oh, so. it comes clear, and it's lovely. If you don't mind, could you say for us one more time where to find you on Kickstarter and on Twitter and on any other social media that you have?
I will. Okay, first of all, our Kickstarter that we're running currently, go to Kickstarter.com and look for Moriarty Returns. Just do a search for Moriarty Returns, and you will find us. Search for me, Daniel Corey, on Kickstarter, and you can find my profile, and you will find my projects, and you will find Moriarty Returns that way. So that's where you find us on Kickstarter. DangerCat.com. DangerCat is my company that basically it serves as an umbrella for all my creative concerns. If you open up your volume of Moriarty once you've purchased it, you will see the DangerCat symbol on the title page, which I'm very proud of to have that in the in an Image comic book. It really legitimizes us. But anyways, that's DangerCat, Danger K-A-T-T, one word, DangerCat.com. is my website. Also, if you go to ProfessorJamesMoriarty.com, that redirects to DangerCat.com. They are one and the same. Whichever one you can remember more, ProfessorJamesMoriarty.com or DangerCat.com. I'm on Twitter, DangerCat, Danger, K-A-T-T, one word. And also, you find me on Facebook, Daniel.Corey, Facebook.com/Daniel.Corey. There's a Moriarty fan page, Moriarty Comic. It's Facebook.com/Moriarty Comic, one word. And become a fan of us there. And yeah, and if you want to find the book, you really have no excuse to not have the book. Let me just tell you, it is everywhere. Okay, BarnesandNoble.com, you can order it. Amazon.com, you can order it. You can go to your local Barnes and Noble and find it on the shelf. If they don't have it, they can order it for you. You can find it at your local comic shop. You can find it if you are into digital comics and Comixology and iVerse. You can download it as downloadable PDFs and read it on your desktop, your device, your pads. Any way you get a book, you can get Moriarty from Image Comics.
Oh, fantastic. Well, thank you so much for speaking with us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks. I had a great time. Thank you so much. The babes, you guys, you lived up to your legend. I didn't have any doubts, but it has been confirmed. The babes have lived up to their legends. Absolutely. So thank you. Thank you for having me on.
You are an honorary Baker Street Babe now, since you have answered our four questions from the beginning. So now,
wonderful.
You can wander about being an honorary Baker Street Babe.
I'm going to tell everybody.
Yeah.
And they're going to think I'm crazy.
Just add initials BSB to the end of your name, and they're going to be like, is that some kind of doctor? You're going to be like,
yes. I'm Corey BSB.
Correct.
Thank you very much. That's wonderful.
No, it's our pleasure. Well, thank you
so much.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. It was a wonderful discussion. So thank you for having me on.
We are happy to have had you on. And best of luck with the Kickstarter. And hopefully we'll be talking to you again when it is a giant success.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Thank you.
Cheers. Talk to you soon. If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you two to one?